time certain item number 1014.
Amend deconstruction of buildings law code to include houses and duplexes built in 1940 or earlier.
Here in the city of Portland, we value sustainability and protecting the environment. Expanding our current deconstruction of buildings law is keeping with Portland's goals and values that will help to bolster that effort. I'd like to read some excerpts from a city report that should sound somewhat familiar if you've been following the demolition debate over the last 5 years or so. The task force has been directed to study new approaches to the issues of housing density and demolition in response to recent events involving the controversial demolition of housing to make way for new residential development. The Oregon economy has recovered from the recession. New apartment and single-family home construction has begun to approach record-breaking levels. The task force has considered options for saving viable housing and historic buildings, ensuring public safety, recycling useful architectural fixtures, protecting the environment, and preserving neighborhood character. These excerpts came from the Housing Task Force report on demolition and density, written more than 30 years ago. I bring this up because the concept and context of what we're discussing today isn't new. We recognize that some houses will be removed as we accommodate more development and density in the city. We also recognize that this cycle has real impacts, to our neighborhoods, our landfills, our environment, and to our health. What's relatively new is the significant steps we're taking to address these issues, projects such as the Residential Infill Project and Better Housing by Design. And 3 years ago, Portland began disrupting the business-as-usual approach to mechanically demolishing houses by requiring deconstruction. This means that houses are now hand-disassembled, materials are salvaged for reuse, and in turn, these materials can be used in everything from sleeping pods for the houseless to handcrafted furniture and finishes that are showcased in our restaurants and coffee houses and elsewhere. Again, it's all about sustainability. Deconstruction also nourishes our continuing initiative to build a circular economy where we move away from a linear model of using something once and then throwing it out and having it go to the landfill, instead finding ways to creatively reuse materials. The process also reduces the carbon footprint created by conventional demolition and helps abate potential harmful public health impacts such as asbestos and lead dust. This is not just made in Portland, it's made from Portland. Thank you for being here today, and we look forward to our presentation.
Good morning. Thank you, Mayor Wheeler and commissioners. My name is Elisa Kane. I'm the Climate Action Manager with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. In 2016, Portland became the first city in North America to require deconstruction for its oldest and most historic houses when proposed for removal. Portland's ordinance ensures valuable materials are salvaged for reuse instead of being burned or landfilled. And during those hearings, we were commended for leading the way, and council was thanked for its leadership on this issue. As you're aware, Portland continues to be looked at as an innovator and incubator for sustainability policies and programs. This deconstruction ordinance is no exception. Other cities were paying close attention when we were doing this work, and now cities such as Vancouver, BC, Palo Alto, Minneapolis, Denver, and San Antonio have either modeled their ordinances on our approach or have installed grant programs and other incentives similar to what we've used in the past. How we manage materials that come from older homes matters. Green building starts with how we remove a house and what becomes of those materials. We also understand that the life cycle impacts are becoming increasingly important as we look for additional ways to reduce carbon emissions and build a resilient city. We used a very long runway to phase in this program. We started out with incentives in 2015. These were grants that were provided to people who wanted to demolish their homes and instead used to use deconstruction as an alternative. And then after seeing what the industry could handle, we enacted the ordinance in 2016. And at that time, some people wanted us to go further. And we promised at that time that we'd be back before the end of 2019 to reconsider advancing the amendment to cover more homes and expand this ordinance. So that's why we're here today, and Sean will share more details of the amendment we're proposing.
Good morning, Mayor Wheeler and Commissioners. Thank you for having us. I'm Sean Wood. I'm the Construction Waste Specialist for the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. And first, I'd like to go over the purpose statement from the deconstruction code language in Title 17. The deconstruction ordinance seeks to maximize the salvage of valuable building materials for reuse, reduce carbon emissions associated with demolition, reduce the amount of demolition waste disposed of in landfills, and minimize the adverse impacts associated with building removal. That's important because it's the why of this ordinance, and it's also the what in terms of measuring success. The current ordinance requires deconstruction for any house or duplex that was built in 1916 or earlier, or if it's a designated historic resource, regardless of age. Houses built in 1916 or earlier represent approximately one-third of annual house demolitions. And in our 26 ordinance, as Elisa mentioned, we established a goal to raise that year built to houses built before 1941 by this year, by 2019. The proposed amendment would expand the ordinance to include houses and duplexes built in 1940 or earlier. These houses are still rich in old-growth lumber found in the framing. The proposed effective date would be January 20th, 2020. We had originally proposed December 31st of 2019 as an effective date. However, BDS asked us if we could avoid that date because there might be a rush on permits around the holiday season when their staffing levels are low. Raising the year-built threshold to 1940 means we would capture approximately two-thirds of annual demolition permits. So while this doubles our capture rate, demolition permits have been declining since 2016. These are the number of annual demolition permit applications since 2016. The orange represents the current ordinance, and the green represents houses built in between 1940 and 1917. As you can see, capturing houses built in or before 1940 puts us back to the level of work when the current ordinance began 3 years ago. Now I'd like to talk about the benefits and outcomes of the ordinance to date. Since the ordinance went into effect in 2016, we've had over 200 house deconstructions, again, one-third of house demolitions. And from those projects, over 2.4 million pounds of material was salvaged for reuse, material that would have otherwise been burned or landfilled. All that salvage material, the avoided impacts of disposal and production, translate to carbon benefits, which we'll hear more about during the panel testimony. While not the primary driver of this policy, the hazardous material benefits of deconstruction are an important one. Deconstruction has always been looked at as a best practice for reducing impacts of hazardous material when compared to mechanical demolition. New BDS requirements that went into effect last year have helped level the playing field by requiring mechanical demolition projects to first hand remove all exterior painted material and then apply water to the structure before and during demolition and loading. However, deconstruction goes further still. All of the certified deconstruction contractors have been trained and certified in lead-based paint and asbestos hazards. This is a condition to maintain their deconstruction certification. This is not the case with mechanical demolition contractors. Familiarity with the potentially asbestos-containing material and the surgical nature of deconstruction mean it is not uncommon that contractors come across unabated asbestos during deconstruction. Work stops, the material is safely removed by an abatement contractor, and then work resumes on the house. This material is likely to go unnoticed and unabated during mechanical demolition. The deconstruction ordinance helps create economic opportunity, not only in deconstruction, but also in the sale, fabrication, and installation of the salvage material. From the beginning, this program has focused on providing opportunities for women, people of color, and other disadvantaged groups in the field of deconstruction. It continues today with current training and newly certified contractors. Preserving and maintaining our existing structures should always be the first approach. But if a house must come down, deconstruction allows us to preserve the irreplaceable materials and craftsmanship and to preserve the built history and the human experience that is tied to it. Portland is a timber town, and our built history reflects that. Our ancient old-growth forests are now standing in our oldest houses. We've seen a lot of changes over the past 3 years. We currently have 12 companies certified to do deconstruction work and 3 additional ones in training. We've had 2 new salvage retail operations open, and the existing and new retailers are adding value to the salvage material, turning it into furniture, siding, and wall cladding. And Oregon State just recently completed successful testing of cross-laminated timber, mass timber panels constructed from deconstructed houses, from the lumber from deconstructed houses in Portland. This industry has the added support of state and regional government looking to further the benefit of material reuse. This ranges from equipment purchase assistance to sponsoring trainings with a focus on women and people of color. Because of the increased competition and innovation, the cost to deconstruct has come down over the past 3 years, and during that same time period, the cost to mechanically demolish has gone up, primarily because of shrinking markets for wood and as industrial fuel and new site and dust control requirements implemented by the Bureau of Development Services, commonly known as SB 871 requirements. 3 years ago, when the current ordinance passed, deconstruction cost approximately $8,000 more than mechanical demolition. Today, the cost difference is anywhere from $0 to $3,000 more for deconstruction. And we know that for every single house deconstruction, an average of 12 new units, single dwelling or multi-dwelling, are constructed as part of the replacement development. That means assuming a $3,000 premium for deconstruction, the added cost is $250 per unit. And I'd like to note that the Home Builders Association has suggested adding an exemption from the deconstruction requirements for houses that are removed for the purpose of constructing affordable housing. Reducing the cost of affordable housing are important, and so too are the benefits of deconstruction. And with that lens, BPS and the Housing Bureau explored the concept and implications of such an exemption. After careful research, discussion, and consideration, BPS and the Housing Bureau did not support an exemption, given the limited financial benefit for these projects, the range of existing exemptions and those on the horizon, the limited number of projects that could take advantage of a deconstruction exemption, and the challenges related to implementation and enforcement. So what about the carrying costs associated with deconstruction? Deconstruction takes longer than mechanical demolition. Maybe 5 to 10 days for deconstruction, a couple of days for mechanical demolition. When we look at permit data timelines for both types of projects, we find that deconstruction projects get their demo permits quicker and break ground on the new replacement projects sooner than mechanical demolition projects. In both cases, the gap between when the demolition permit is issued and when the new project begins is 3.4 months. This suggests that not only does the longer deconstruction duration not impact carrying costs, there is also plenty of time to get the job done. So why raise the year built threshold now? The deconstruction contractors and salvage retailers are ready for more projects and material. The industry has matured and expanded, and these companies are actively investing in the future with new equipment, new space, and new staff and crew. They're ready for this expansion and are anticipating it. As I mentioned earlier, we've seen a decline in demolition permits since 2016. Expanding now means there is little risk to overwhelming the industry or the market, which is always an important consideration. The industry has a firm footing and has adapted in ways we couldn't have imagined. I have no reason to believe that that won't be the case going forward as the landscape changes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Does that complete your testimony?
It does.
All right, good. We have an invited panel. Thank you for the testimony. Shane Endicott from the Northwest Deconstruction Specialist, Jackie Kerouac-Fram from the Rebuilding Center, Emily Christensen from Goodwood Deconstruction and Salvage, and Jordan Palmieri from the Oregon DEQ. Come on up and welcome, and thank you for being here to help support this ordinance. If you want to just drag one more chair up, go ahead. Thanks. Thank you very much. And the microphone slide around. Welcome. And if you could just state your name for the record, we'd appreciate it. I don't know who'd like to go first.
Start.
All right. Thank you.
Great. Good Good morning, Mayor Wheeler and City Commissioners. My name is Jordan Palmieri, and I work in the Materials Management Program at the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. I'm here today to talk about some of the environmental benefits of this city's deconstruction policy, with a particular focus on the carbon impacts. For the last 20 years, DEQ has supported deconstruction and building material reuse projects around the state. Over that time, we provided grants to deconstruction businesses to support truck purchases. We've supported material racking and display systems for retail outlets, and even supported a grant to help train the initial workforce for the policy being discussed here today. When we look at reducing the carbon impacts of building materials, it's really important to first understand where those impacts occur. For most building materials, the largest impacts happen during the production of those materials, not during the use or disposal. The carbon impacts of material production are often referred to as embodied carbon. While there are many ways to address the production-related impacts, material salvage and reuse offers a really powerful pathway to reduce impacts. Material reuse interrupts the produce, consume, dispose cycle of our economy and reduces our demand for new materials. To better understand the potential benefits of reduced material demand, we conducted a detailed analysis of the carbon and energy impacts of the first 36 homes that went through your program after passed in 2016. The goals of the research were to understand the net impacts of your policy and provide that information to the city and other jurisdictions in Oregon considering a similar policy. We found that compared to mechanical demolition, the average home being deconstructed in Portland has a carbon benefit twice as large as a home being mechanically demolished. So it turns out that your policy does, in fact, have significant carbon benefits. As the program grows, it will be important to provide continued support for salvaged material market development, since the carbon benefits of projects are only realized when the material displaces the purchase and production of a new material. Finally, I do think it's important to provide a sense of scale for the carbon benefits gained through policies that address our consumption of materials. We're currently in an era of climate change where the scale and timing of our policy responses is really critically important. City Council recently passed a single-use plastics reduction policy, which aims to reduce the demand for new plastic items. Similarly, the deconstruction policy aims to reduce the demand for new building materials. To compare these policies, one Portland resident would have to decline single-use plastic utensils about 162,000 times to equal the carbon benefit of one deconstructed home. So just as we can reduce the demand for single-use plastic utensils, the city is leading the way to reduce the demand for single-use building materials. Thank you so much for your time and attention.
Thank you. And thanks for also reminding us that this isn't just about diverting landfill. This is also about reducing the production cycle. So thanks for underscoring that point. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Mayor Wheeler and distinguished commissioners.
Good morning. It's good to see you again. Welcome back.
Thanks. My name is Shane Endicott. I'm with Northwest Deconstruction Specialists. Came straight here from a job site. We also, not only do we deconstruct houses and any size building, really from a garage to multi-story apartment buildings, but we also have a retail outlet that's not advertised or marketed because it's a temporary space. We're there month to month, so it's all word of mouth and people just curious wandering in. But we're still able to fill a 50,000 square foot space packed and keep the materials moving out. We have been in business since the ordinance took effect, and we have been doing primarily whole houses. And we've noticed a change over the last 3 years that is really important to note, that the buildings that we started out were just exclusively on the ordinance, but as we've worked with clients who've come back and word of mouth, they've had us deconstructing more and more homes and buildings that are not required to be deconstructed. We've been also, as we've been deconstructing, I think every house we've deconstructed, which we've done over 20 each year, we have found asbestos in the process, sometimes multiple times, with the exception of four structures that we did not find asbestos in. So there's a lot that you uncover while we're peeling the house back. In response to Sean's BES's presentation, we have been very successful in achieving, I think, some of the goals of the deconstruction ordinance. 90% of our employees are people of color and women, and 100% are in leadership and management roles in our company, our organization. We have been able to donate lots of materials to different projects throughout the city and beyond. We also donate to the Rebuilding Center, Habitat Restore, and people actually in the neighborhood. People will see us working and come by. Some of them are living outside of a home and have asked us for materials, and we frequently donate things right on the spot. And we have a lot of ownership throughout our organization with the employees. They want to move this beyond just taking houses down, but facilitate conversations in the community about how we can advance reducing our carbon footprint through doing performance art through our projects and other things to engage community. So we need a space first to be able to do all that. I also want to just make sure that I mention I think I covered everything. we're an Oregon benefit company, and we're in strong support of it increasing the year to 1940 and earlier. We see opportunities that we could be growing, tripling what we're currently doing, and also we're serving by helping other deconstruction companies realize the value of their materials, making it more economically viable for them as well, and we just see there's a lot of opportunity here. So the ordinance has ripple effects beyond just the environmental and the job component. It's also doing all these other positive benefits.
Very good.
Thank you.
Commissioner Hardesty, did you have a comment?
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Shane. I am very impressed with the fact that you can be here at the City Council and say that 90% of your workforce are people of color, and the leadership is 100% people of color. I sit here often and hear people just can't find people of color no matter how hard they try for work. And so that doesn't happen by accident that your workforce is that reflective of the community. How did you do that?
Well, it's organically, but through relationships.
Say that again.
Through relationships.
So you knew people.
Well, no, actually, people were attracted to what we were offering. We really promoted that we wanted people to be able to come in and not just be labor and take buildings down, but if they were interested in advancing. And by no surprise, nearly everyone wanted to advance. So what we did is we lay out a program where we pay for training and we pay for them to have that opportunity, and then they take over those roles within the company. And we're much more successful because of it. And we also have people who then they want other people to work there that they have relationships with, and that's how it grows. They start telling everyone, you should come and work here. We have the problem of a lot of people want to work there, but we don't have enough openings. So that's a good problem, because we could fix that problem.
We could certainly fix that problem. Would you be kind enough to leave your contact info at my office? Because I want to talk to you, because it's fascinating to me that it's so hard for some individuals to actually be intentional about ensuring that we have a diverse workforce and that we're reflective of the community. And quite frankly, I love old wood. So anybody that's like taking old housing apart is somebody that I really like, right? But I want to learn more. I want to learn more about your training, the fact your investment in people, and then how that leads into leadership, because you could help a lot of folks actually get over that hurdle of not knowing anybody.
We're an open source.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Commissioner Fritz.
Sean, would you mind sharing what you shared with my staff about the role of the city's prime contractor development program in your training? The prime contractor development program?
The prime contractor development program as far as our work?
Yeah, about how you did. I understand that they paid for some of the training with the cost of the contractors.
Not with us.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
But you could.
We could. We most definitely could. I apologize. We did hire employees from the deconstruction training. And as far as I know, we're the only company that's still retaining someone from that program. But many of them have gone on the move through our organization. Went on to do other construction work, so stay in the field. But that's right. Yeah. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me, Mayor Wheeler, commissioners. My name is Emily Christensen. I'm the co-owner of Goodwood Deconstruction, Salvage, and Design. Just wanted to back up and talk about how we formed. David, my partner, and I heard about the ordinance on the radio. We were in the process of deconstructing a big farmhouse out in Hillsborough just on our own with a group of friends, because I had designed an ADU for our backyard, and we were trying to gather a large lot of matching wood with which to build it. Going to Home Depot was out of the question for me, but we had a hard time finding enough, but basically we had a hard time spending so much time searching around the various salvage yards and Craigslist trying to find a matching lot of wood that would apply to our design. When we heard about the ordinance, we just turned around and asked everyone we were working with, hey, do you want to start a crew? And Goodwood was born. We never did build that ADU, but we have had a lot of fun building up Goodwood for the last 3 years. As you know, the ordinance has been such a success. There are so many wonderful things about it, any of which would justify expanding it to 1940. But the thing I keep thinking about is the quantity of reclaimed wood that now is in the marketplace due to the ordinance. Before the ordinance, you needed to hunt and peck all over town to find enough wood for your project. And the ordinance really changed that. It took what was a rare and hard to find material and made it available, consistent, and dependable. That's a huge change. But in order to fundamentally affect wood purchasing habits in the trades and to expand the use of reclaimed wood in place of new wood, we believe we have to speak the language of builders and designers. We have to make reclaimed wood easy to purchase, easy to use, and scalable. And to do that, we need more wood. We heartily support the expansion of the ordinance because we want to change the purchasing habits of folks within the building industry. Expansion reduces the amount of material going into the landfill, but perhaps more importantly, it provides the quantity of material needed to make reclaimed wood a viable alternative to new wood, a crucial step toward reducing deforestation. Our motto is deconstruct, don't cut. But we have to offer a viable alternative to new wood, and with the expansion, I believe we can. Goodwood is anticipating the expansion by opening up a wood store this month in the heart of the design district at the Burnside Bridgehead. We've had a salvage warehouse retail space in Northeast for 2 years, but this will be a different type of enterprise. This store will be modeled after a regular store. So we'll have a predictable inventory from which to shop. We'll have 7 consistent found profiles and 14 consistent remilled profiles. With the expansion, we'll be able to size up to fill larger orders, and when customers run out and need more of the same wood, they can get it. We want to meet builders and designers where they are. We want to bring reclaim to them by presenting it in the same way they're used to seeing new lumber presented. We want to make using reclaimed easy, and in order to reach critical mass, we need to have enough reclaimed wood to offer consistency and scalability. And to do that, we encourage Council to expand the ordinance. I brought a couple of examples of our remilled profiles. This is what they call a square joint T&G. So it'd be for walls or floors or ceiling. Another example back there is of a V-groove. So this would be a typical profile you would buy in a new wood store, but made with 100% recycled wood. So in some of those new, you know, condominium builds that you're seeing on Martin Luther King these days, the entryway could be reclaimed wood instead of tiger wood from the Amazon. So we're really looking to position ourselves as a resource to start shifting the narrative toward a more, sustainable model of building.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Thanks for sharing your story. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry you didn't actually end up building your ADU. It sounds
me too.
But thanks for sharing the process. That's really informative. Helps us. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Mayor, Commissioners. I'm Jackie Kerouac-Fram, and I'm the Executive Director of the Rebuilding Center. And I'm here to talk a little bit more about the social impact of the ordinance. So as you may know, the Rebuilding Center is a nonprofit with a mission to build community resilience through reuse and repair of reclaimed building materials. And of the 1,800 tons of materials we diverted from landfills last year, a substantial percentage was reclaimed lumber. In the years past, our own deconstruction service had provided much of that lumber. But with the passage of the Portland Deconstruction Ordinance in 2016, a new and wonderful community of for-profit deconstruction firms is very competently serving the deconstruction needs of the Portland region. And as a result, this past July, we decided to halt our own deconstruction operations. But due in part to the partnership of some of these for-profit partners, we continue to sell tons of reclaimed lumber, and it continues to be one of our best-selling, most-loved item categories. There are a whole lot of people who need lumber for various projects. And for those who do not need high-end old-growth lumber, and even for those who do, we have that also. But we exist to provide this affordable alternative for people who want to prioritize reuse or who cannot afford to purchase new material or to purchase reclaimed material at one of the more retail boutique-type retail outlets. The people that we serve, more than 25,000 people per year, they want this material. And in addition to the lumber, at the Rebuilding Center, we also offer all manner of things that come out of a deconstructed house, right? So appliances, lighting, fixtures, all manner of things that people can use to repair and renovate their homes, to be able to stay in their homes for longer, especially if they're at risk of displacement. And these people, all of our customers, but in particular these more vulnerable populations, would greatly benefit from the increased amount of lumber and materials that we could stand to provide if this ordinance is passed. Moving the year to 1940 will provide a fantastic supply of these materials that our customers will put back into the circulation through countless projects to enhance their quality of life affordably and sustainably. We at the Rebuilding Center believe that the sustainability is best practice at the neighborhood level, and one of the best ways to do that is to maintain resources within a community. And this ordinance will help continue to make that happen. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it very much. Colleagues, any questions of this panel? Very good. Thank you all for being in here. Thank you for your support of this important ordinance. Next up, Carla, we have public testimony. How many people do we have signed up?
We have six people signed up.
Very good.
The first three, please come on up, are Shedrick J. Wilkins, John Sandy, and Barbara Kerr.
Good morning.
Morning. Yeah, I'm Shedrick Wilkins. I favor deconstruction. I think the best building material of modern time are bricks. You make a brick building, and I like to go in the East Bank Saloon or something where they have exposed plumbing or exposed wires, because actually a lot of times in modern construction we want to like put paneling and bury wires, and plumbing, or pour, if you have pipes with lead pipes, you pour concrete over the top. Well, concrete cracks, okay? And you've got this stuff stuck in there, and then electrical things in the future, there are ideas that maybe we'll just have solar panels on the roof and use 6 volts for LED lights. But the whole idea was you've got this 120 volts of electricity and you've got to shield it from the kids, so you bury it in the wall, okay? And you use asbestos paneling. And what it means is you have to tear the whole thing down. And there are skyscrapers and community colleges made with concrete that are eventually just going to crack up, and where brick buildings will still be around. And they knew this too. When they had the bicentennial in colonial America, they found a lot of the brick buildings are still good. And they don't have floors. The bricks go down, and so you build wood for a floor. The plumbing is not encased in concrete. The roof can come off. You could put solar panels on the roof and readjust the roof. And bricks are very good, and they last. And concrete doesn't, it cracks, and you're burying stuff in the walls. My dad was an amateur electrician one time. Electrician spends half of his time getting into the wall. Where at some of these taverns or buildings like East Bank, you can see the plumbing go over here on the bottom, and you can see the wires on the top. You don't have to fight the building. And bricks are very good.
Thank you. Good morning.
Okay.
Good morning.
Oh, okay. John's first.
Go ahead. Thank you.
Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. My name is John Sandy. I'm a resident of Northeast Portland and a member of UNR.
Thank you.
Let me put a little historical context on this present proposal. Back in May of 2014, while doing research on residential demolitions, United Neighborhoods for Reform discovered 2 landmark scientific studies in Baltimore and Chicago documenting the propagation of lead-based dust, paint dust, during urban demolitions. Subsequently, additional academic studies at Wayne State and UIC verified and added much to these earlier studies. Through, at times frustrating but persistent, efforts of enlightening municipal and state employees to these studies' findings, UNR and other civic-minded citizens successfully achieved the passage of Oregon state laws to put proper legal weight on responsible residential demolitions requirements and best practices. The Portland ordinance that was mentioned, in accordance with the state best practices, it went into effect July 1st of 2018, and the City Council will hear of its effectiveness and challenges and needs for improvement later this year during the DRAC subcommittee presentation. Along this journey, it became apparent that the public health benefits of deconstruction augmented the environmental and salvage benefits, further promoting the need for broadening deconstruction requirements and use. The construction, as was mentioned earlier in the panel, the construction market has seen the need and benefits of expanding deconstruction usage and filled this void effectively, overcoming initial concerns of not having the capacity to handle the additional load and acting as an impediment to new development. And again, as was earlier mentioned, the key thing is, let me reiterate, let's not understate the importance of the adding of critical construction trades training along the way. Therefore, if the Council does not support this proposal, you are in essence discounting the countless hours dedicated to meetings of advisory groups and numerous workshop events that called upon the collective wisdom of a wide range of industry and public experts regarding all phases of demolitions and the benefits of deconstruction. I urge you to actively support this proposal. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Mayor and Commissioners, my name is Barbara Kerr. Been here before. I live in East Columbia neighborhood, and I firmly believe in deconstruction. I started a company, Rejuvenation, based on salvaging and reusing house parts, and I am the United Neighborhoods for Reform representative on the DAG, the Deconstruction Advisory Group. But today I'm speaking as a concerned citizen. Mayor, I want to say I really appreciate the quote that you gave from 30 years ago. It illustrates how long we've been working on this. And by updating this ordinance, we move ahead on reducing what goes into the landfill, on reusing materials rather than using up natural resources to produce new, on decreasing lead being spread into our neighborhoods, on creating green jobs, and on the multitude of other benefits of deconstruction. To not extend the years covered would not make sense. But before congratulating ourselves on moving forward, we must be honest that until deconstruction is the way we remove all buildings, not just those built before advancing cutoff dates, there will still be more lead pulverized by mechanical demolitions. We will still be filling our landfills with materials that could have been reused to minimize depleted natural resources, And we will not have had, the used materials that can spawn creative reuse jobs that we haven't even imagined yet. And before we reach to pat ourselves on the back for moving forward from recycling to reuse, especially in light of how we've been having problems with recycling, we must face the fact that we need to be working on reduce. Deconstruction is reusing building materials, but we need to move up to reducing the use of materials by reusing the existing buildings. As the gentleman from DEQ said, which, you know, we need to look at embodied energy, and it's more embodied in the building as it stands. Deconstruction is honorable only when a building must come down. We cannot afford to greenwash demolitions by saying at least we are deconstructing, that existing houses are the only true greenhouses and that existing houses are the only true affordable homes are not just sound bites to be ignored. We cannot honestly say that we are a city that values sustainability if we are demolishing in the name of being green, when we know that reusing an existing building has less of a carbon footprint than new construction, no matter how much green or reused materials are involved. We cannot honestly say we are concerned about the houseless, the displaced, or even high rents if we demolish homes in the name of density rather than supporting reuse of homes to provide increased housing that people can afford. We are eliminating opportunities for the disenfranchised communities, young families, and our elders to become or remain independent rather than be forced into higher cost apartments instead of fixer uppers. If we hide behind our deconstruction ordinance to cover up what we are doing to our housing and our communities, we have nothing to brag about.
Thank you. Commissioner Fritz.
Thank you. I hope you will save that speech and come and give it again when we do the residential infill project, because I think it's a very important point. I want to thank John and Barbara and all of the folks who have been participating in United Neighborhoods for Reform for now 5 years. And this was an alliance of neighborhood associations from across coalitions who came to council with the not unreasonable request that homes should not be demolished. We're sprinkling lead and asbestos all over the neighborhood. There were those who said these are just NIMBYs, although actually it's okay to not want asbestos and lead in your backyard. There were those who said it was that folks were against affordable housing, that all kinds of unkind at best comments were made, and you persisted. And this is the reason I think we're celebrating today, because people said that deconstruction was going to be much too expensive. They said that it wasn't going to have the outcomes that you claimed, and you persisted. And so I just want to thank you and other neighborhood associations who are here today, because you have the privilege of being able to be here on a Wednesday morning, and also representing people who also would rather not have lead and asbestos in their backyards, but can't be here. So thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, both of you. Next three, please, Carla.
Are Kathy Weber, David Bimek, and Maggie.
Welcome. Come on up. Name for the record, 3 minutes each, please. You look ready to go. Would you like to start, please? Thank you.
My name is Caitlin Weber. I'm here on behalf of Restore Oregon, and as of Monday, I'm a new member of the Draft Demolition Subcommittee.
Thank you.
Mayor and City Commissioners, I'm here to express Restore Oregon's enthusiastic support for expanding the deconstruction program to include houses and duplex built in or before 1940. The pilot program has led the country in ensuring valuable and irreplaceable building materials are not wasted. It has proven successful at working out a process for the salvage and reuse of deconstructed materials, as well as suppression of hazardous materials born of demolition, and it has now has the capacity to expand. Growing the program to include more homes will uphold and strengthen Portland's goals and values, including support of a trained, diverse workforce, reduction of exposure to hazardous materials, sustainability of our city by reducing our carbon footprint and keeping usable material out of landfills, reuse of rare old-growth lumber and other materials, and, perhaps most importantly for our mission, making people think twice before demolishing a historic building. Portland is now at the leading edge of an expanding deconstruction industry, which translates to more jobs, the availability of more affordable building material, better health, and a more intact historic fabric. We commend Portland City Council's initiation of a robust reuse ethic, and Restore Oregon strongly supports this expansion by approving the amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. You want to go ahead, sir?
Hello. My name's Dave Benick. I'm with the Building Deconstruction Institute, and I wanted to let you guys know that I've been with you for 4 years now, supporting you and your efforts. And when you guys passed the ordinance, you showed support for our industry, and so then I wanted to return that by supporting your efforts. And so some of the things that I've been doing, training your contractors, training your workers, working with the Prime Development Contractor Program, which you mentioned, so I trained all of those folks. And what it's been about is building up the infrastructure so that when you make the leap, you know, that we have the support to catch you, you know. And here we are at the verge of making another, potentially making another leap. So I wanted to let you know that I'm here, I'm gonna remain here to support you, to continue to train people, to continue to build up infrastructure. One of the things that I did, as soon as you passed the ordinance, the very first thing I did was focus my efforts on buildings that were not 100 years old or older. And you see, the point being that you had already accomplished that, and I no longer needed to try. I needed to try for the new buildings. So almost all the buildings that we've deconstructed in our trainings have been newer buildings so that we have proof of concept so you can feel like you have something, this isn't unproven ground, okay? Mm-hmm. Today I'm here really representing 12 other cities that I'm helping across the country. So some of those cities were mentioned actually, and I held an event in Pennsylvania last week where we got everyone together, and one of the topics was Portland. You know, that was probably one of the main things, that they were looking to you for guidance. They were, you know, somebody has to go first. You did. So they're ready to go second, but I want to let you know that there are 50 cities probably that will follow them, right? It's like exponential. So whatever you do here today is going to be, could be exponentially replicated in the future in a positive way. So all of the work that we've done, all of the goals that you have about employing people of color, women, our goal is to have companies that are run by people of color and women, and that's who we've actually been training. I would say maybe 80% of the contractors that I've been training fall in that category. So they're It's not a. I'm sorry, my time's up. So.
No, you still have. Go ahead.
Yeah. Go on.
Okay. I think it. In the end, sometimes our efforts. You know, it seems like we're trying to help a certain group. You know, we're trying to give them advantages. You know, to close the gap. And, you know, that sort of thing. But in our eyes, it's really we're trying to allow people to help others. You know. By helping them, they're going to help others. And that's really been our main focus of this program. It goes way beyond just a single company.
Great. Thank you. We appreciate that very much. Good morning, Maggie.
Hi, Maggie, Portland Homeless Town Hall. A couple of years ago, I went online and I saw the number of abandoned residential buildings in arrears on their taxes were in the hundreds. And I want to know, why can't these owners get a write-off if they donate their materials for tiny homes? How many tiny homes could you make out of these reclaimed out of this reclaimed lumber from one house? That's what I want to know. Also, I want to know about how they're disposing of the lead and the asbestos materials, because I think that's a huge concern about hazardous materials. Are they going to dispose of it in a landfill where it's going to be open and it's going to be rained on and it's going to leach into water? So I think we need to pay attention to that, because that's a health issue for people. And then the other thing I would like to say is I would encourage homeowners that want to deconstruct, please consider donating your, or having homeless people come in and take apart your wood and let them make a tiny home with it. And also these properties that you guys are going to reclaim, I've talked to the Joint Office of Homeless Services, and what they want to do is this multi-generational duplexes, but that leaves out single disabled people who are aging, no matter what their color or their gender. And I think there's a lot of discrimination against single people, and you could take an eighth of a quarter an acre, a quarter of an acre, and put on 4 to 8 tiny homes and have people living in what's called a residentially owned commons, and just have the land be owned by the government, and then have the people be a community who are organizing themselves. And I think you could do a lot of low income little housing this way, and it's legal. Oregon has a program for this. It's legal to do it, to take single people who are low income and could never afford a home, and just if you're demolitioning a property and you've taken over that property, and just you guys can own the land and they will own their little home, and they will be a residentially owned commons, and they will do all their own maintenance and landscaping and pay the insurance liability, and but they can't afford a house by themselves.
All right, thank you, Maggie. Thanks all three of you, we appreciate it. Commissioner Udaly.
Oh, thank you, Mayor. So this is an ordinance, which means it comes back next week for a vote, but since we have advocates in the room, I just wanted to make some brief remarks. This was one of the first city issues that I got engaged in before I joined council, and I'm excited to have it come back. Many advocates at the time wanted the exemption to be decreased, including myself, but there was a real lack of capacity in the deconstruction industry, so I'm thrilled to hear that that is no longer the case. While I'd prefer to see fewer historic homes taken down, as some of you have indicated as well, deconstruction is at least a more fitting final tribute to the superior materials and craftsmanship that went into these beautiful homes. I want to thank the state legislature for SB 871, which allowed us to establish standards around lead abatement. That issue was raised as well. And my chief of staff, Marshall Runkle, for leading the charge on developing that program. Portland was the first city in Oregon to establish a lead abatement standards in deconstruction and demolition. So thank you to the mayor's office, BPS staff, and the industry, and I'm really looking forward to voting yes next week.
Very good. Commissioner Fritz.
Thank you. I also would like to give my comments both today and next week, because I think they bear repeating. This is really fantastic. I was in charge of the Bureau of Development Services from 2013 to the middle of 2017, and it was the community who came to us wanting fewer demolitions and also very concerned about when things are demolished, the safety of that. So I want to thank Nancy Thorington and the previous director, Paul Scarlett, in the Bureau of Development Services for their work. First of all, at least saying, let's notify people. But then the United Neighborhoods for Reform, you did not stop at that. You insisted that the Bureau's act, and so the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability moved forward with investigating this work. Thank you, Sean Wood and Alyssa Kane, also former director Susan Anderson, as well as the current director Andrea Durbin. This has been a great example of inter-bureau and inter-commissioner collaboration, and I very much appreciate it. Claire Adamsick on my staff was my liaison to development services and then to neighborhood involvement, and now to the Office of Equity and Human Rights. So again, it's a matter of all of these different bureaus with different directors and commissioners working together to do really good things for our community, which are now the standard for the nation, as we heard, and glad to hear that Milwaukee and Vancouver, BC, and Palo Alto and others, and indeed, as Commissioner Udaly alluded to, now instead of two companies, 12 companies. That is real. These are good jobs doing good work, and I appreciate very much those who are doing the training in partnership with the Prime Development Prime Contractor Development Program. Really good work. Thank you very much. I also look forward to voting aye next week.
Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. Could I have the staff come back up? I just have one question. Thank you so much for your hard work on this, and I am in absolutely total support. My only question is on page 5 when we talk about enforcement and penalties. It appears extremely low for if we have a requirement. $500 is not even petty cash for a major developer. And so how did we come to those fines and the violations and the penalties? Where did they come from?
So the enforcement fees are tiered. So a first offense, I believe, is up to $500, and then it graduates up from there.
$1,500. I mean, talking about big, high-dollar contracts.
And so there's another component to that, that if improper use of heavy machinery is used.
I saw the
$10,000. And then we also, if it's an infraction from a certified deconstruction contractor, we have the ability to fine them, but also remove them from the list of certified contractors. So those combined basically have an even larger economic impact.
Mayor, I don't know what the will of the group is, but I'm troubled by the fact that we say this is our vision, and then we give people lots of chances to screw it up, and then when we catch them, which we rarely do, we give them a mealy fine. I cannot support this at such a low fine level. I support everything else, but I just think if you're going to hold people accountable, they got to feel it, right? This is not something they're going to feel. So that's where I am.
Mayor.
Commissioner Daly.
I agree that the fines are too low. I mean, I will support it either way, but I would like a better analysis of how we came up with those numbers and why they're not higher. I would like to see people who are violating our rules, who I'm assuming are well aware of them, pay something more commensurate with the actual impact to the environment and the value of the materials that they're wasting.
Do we know how many violations there have been?
There have been approximately 4, and some of those were related to the property owner not doing what they were supposed to be doing. So that was basically improper use of heavy machinery. We've had a couple of contractors that were certified early on in the ordinance, and they violated some of the requirements, and so they were fined. They pretty quickly left the industry. They were another type of contractor, construction contractor, or something like that. And the whole reason why we have certified deconstruction contractors is to have a level of professionalism, a level of understanding of what we're talking about. And you know, if there's one thing that we've done as part of this ordinance that really works, it's making sure that we have certified contractors. So they've been trained, they're familiar with asbestos, with lead-based paint hazards, they're accountable both financially financially and on wanting to stay on that list. So if for some reason they do something wrong and they're not on that list, they're not getting a call the next day to offer a bid on a new project. So it's been a very small amount of infractions. And I think especially at this point, those were early on. At this point, people know what's expected. We have high level of training for these folks. And enforcement has not been an issue. So while I totally respect what you're saying, and we set that $10,000 limit for heavy machinery because we were afraid that some folks would look at that as the cost of doing business. We'll knock the house down, we'll pay the $10,000 and move on. But we haven't seen that at all.
And every house that gets taken down, whether it's demolished or deconstructed, has to have a demolition permit, is that correct?
That's correct.
And presumably the development services staff tell them when they get their permit that you have to deconstruct this house?
It's essentially all automated. So when they come in for their demolition permit, the permit system pings the assessor database, populates the year built of the structure, and if it's literally a calculation less than or equal to 1916 currently, it drops in a process line that BPS has to review, and then we make sure that there's a certified contractor associated with that project. They let us know that through a online portal that only they have access to with a password, so we know someone's not telling us, oh, this contractor's going to do it, it'll be deconstructed, only to find out later they weren't involved at all. And then once the project's complete, the certified deconstruction contractor follows up with a post-deconstruction form and receipts for the materials. So I have really zero concern that we're not getting these houses deconstructed. There's multiple points in the permit review and inspection process that we would catch that.
Commissioner Fish.
Two things. One is I might suggest, because I think it's a good question to ask and we need some more data, I would just suggest that we kick this issue to the DRAC and with an instruction to have staff update the DRAC on what is the level of compliance. Is there a problem with compliance? And if so, would an adjustment in the penalty schedule? We can take that up at any time.
That's correct.
As an amendment. I would feel more comfortable doing that on the basis of actual data that is presented to us. If I could also just add my strong support to this ordinance, and just add one other piece of history. Commissioner Fritz and I were on the council when then Mayor Adams decided to take the Planning Bureau and bring sustainability into their core mission, and thus was rebranded Planning and Sustainability. And since then, we have been focused on sustainability in a way that the city really wasn't as much before. The deconstruction ordinance occurred under Mayor Hales, and I'm just thinking back to the 4 years or whenever when we did this. I remember there was some pushback and some big questions out there. It is extraordinary now to see the success which you've achieved, the number of certified contractors, the number of people who are benefiting from jobs, good jobs, and the opportunity to grow in those jobs, the environmental impacts, of course. But I want to acknowledge that while this is a proud day, as is some other things we're doing around fossil fuel infrastructure and other things, it started with a vision around sustainability. And I think you can point to each mayor that Amanda and I have served with has helped move that conversation forward a little bit around sustainability. And I'm personally delighted to hear that Portland is a leader nationally in this conversation. We're going to be coming to council soon with an idea that's long overdue around the environment, where I think we're 171st in the country to act. So it's nice to hear about our leadership and the impact of our action and encouraging other cities to follow suit. I just also want to thank our professional team for their great work.
Thank you,
this
Commissioner.
This is really good work. There were a lot of details to be worked out. There are a lot of reasons why this could have gone sideways, and it's a credit to your doggedness and professionalism that we're able to have a hearing today where we have the chorus coming out and saying, expand the program. That's really a credit to your good work, and we thank you for that.
Thank you. I just wanted to unwrap an acronym that my colleague used, Development Review Advisory Committee. When you said DRAC, I didn't know what the heck you were talking about.
Well, it's Halloween.
It's
Halloween.
Yeah. Good old DRAC.
Is there a balance committee that often makes recommendations? I just think it does seem like that's the logical place to go and look at the fee schedule and have them make a recommendation to us.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. I think that's a very fine idea. And again, I don't want to slow down this process at all because I absolutely, totally support the work that's been done and the expansion. I just think that if we're going to hold people accountable, we got to really hold them accountable, and $500 just won't do it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. And so there's going to be absolutely no suspense leading up to next week's vote. Since I brought this, obviously I support it. But I just want to add something here. There is a sense of urgency to the work we're doing around the climate. And this is a part of it. And as I threatened a couple of weeks ago, you're going to hear the term circular economy a lot more in this chamber going forward. And this is a key part of it. We started with 100% renewable energy ordinance. We worked on the plastics ordinance. We're bringing back the fossil fuel ordinance so it will actually stick, because it will be modernized and it will comport with the guidance that the judge gave us when they rejected the 2016 platform that we'd put forward. And so this deconstruction ordinance expansion then comports with that. And there's a lot more that we're going to be doing. And I want to appreciate the work that the BPS team has done. I want to appreciate the work that all the leaders and the advocates in the community have continued to do on this hard work. Obviously, my team will continue to provide what leadership we need to provide to keep this process moving forward. And I'll do what I need to do as mayor to work with my colleagues. And collectively, we will continue to lead. So I just want to appreciate the great work that you've done. I agree with Commissioner Fish that the question of the schedule, particularly given that we're talking about a relatively small number of violations, it is a legitimate issue that Commissioner Hardesty has raised. It is one that the DRAC should, in fact, take up, but I don't think it needs to slow down this ordinance in any way. So without further ado, this is a first reading of a non-emergency ordinance. It moves to second reading. Thank you, and thanks for everyone who testified and everybody who helped work on this.